Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Smina Rahman, sex med gynecologist and menopause specialist in Chicago. Today, I'm so excited to have two of my favorites on today. We're going to have like this, I don't know, threesome going on today. we're going to talk about something that, you know, over half of the population is affected by. I actually had just finished a podcast and I had to go get my vulva. So this is perfect.
Yes.
On demand. For those of you watching on YouTube, vulva on demand here. We're going to talk about vulva vaginal health, and we're going to talk about all the things that you're burning, itching, and anything else that comes up, AI and all the things. But first of all, I want to introduce Dr. Meredith McClure, who's a board certified OBGYN in North Dallas and has been there since 2007. She does vulvovaginal diseases, sexual medicine, menopause, as well as Dr. Ashley Fuller. I'm going to let them introduce themselves a little bit further on and tell us everything we need to know about them in 60 seconds or less. Go. No, I'm just kidding. Why don't you start, Meredith?
Okay. I'm Meredith McClure. I'm a OBGYN by training, and I practice in Dallas. Grew up in Dallas, so this is home for me, and I love everything menopause, hormones, vulvas, and sex, and I love helping people to optimize their lives and sexual health, so it's a blast.
They're part of the labialogic crew, so you guys are the labialogic. So that's the other thing I forgot to say. Go ahead, Ashley.
I'm Ashley Fuller, and I am also a board-certified OBGYN. I'm in Seattle, Washington, so we're getting multiple parts of the country covered between the three of us, which is awesome. And I work in the same space. You know, sexual health is my overarching focus, but definitely menopause, perimenopause, complex vaginal disease, and sexual health. So they all go together. You can't really do one without the others. And I love working in the space and super excited to talk to you guys today. I love talking about this stuff, obviously.
Yeah. So probably will be no surprise to the people that listen. We all met at Ishwish. So because that's where, you know, all the rock stars go. And so we actually have all the fun. But no, seriously. So Meredith and Ashley and I met at Ishwish. And, you know, we always see each other once or twice a year, depending on which conference we're at. And then sometimes just randomly otherwise, but it's always fun to catch up. And, you know, we're all so passionate about the same topic. That's why it makes it so much funner, I think. And you guys have your own love story, how you guys met.
We do.
Love it. It just fills my heart.
Yeah, we met in residency. So, as you know, all three of us are OBGYN. So, as you know, OBGYN is a four-year program, and I was a fourth year resident here in Dallas at Parkland Hospital, our county hospital, and I had this wonderful intern, which is the first year, and she was amazing, and I loved her then, and then time goes on, and you get to know, almost 20 years later, here we are again, and just having a blast.
Meredith was a really nice upper level. She let me go to the bathroom.
Oh, that's you guys probably graduated around, you know, the same time that I did in terms of, like, you know, maybe the 80-hour work week was just starting to kind of, but, like, not everyone was paying
attention. Perfecting.
we'll slip between the cracks. You can work 100 hours this week. We're not going to really, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel like.
Don't say anything.
Don't say anything. They can't do anything to us yet. They just started. So, you know, we sort of were in that, you know, era, and it was hard. I think that's why, you know, so many of us will stay in touch with the friends that we made from residency, because it's a difficult residency. It's a difficult, time of life where, you know, you're working all these crazy hours. So, and now we're on the other side and none of us to go be anymore.
Exactly.
Wait, what did you guys talk about?
I started telling my husband last night, I was like, God, we're coming up on 7 years since I stopped.
Yes.
Yeah. 2019, I think, was the last time I delivered a baby.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I beat all of you. I think that was 2016 when I stopped.
Nice. Yeah. it's a wonderful profession.
I love it.
And it is so rewarding. It's extremely stressful, but it is so rewarding.
Yeah. I was telling a story because I, when I first stopped OB, because I had been a hospitalist and I started my own insurance-based practice, where I was going to do only GYN. And then I was like, wait, am I giving up OB too soon? And so there was a doctor at the Northwestern community that wanted, like, he wanted help with call coverage. And he was like, oh, I'll bring you into my practice once a week. And I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't give up OB yet. So then I went back and did OB for like 1 or 2 years. But I did it as a private practice doc because I had previously worked in academics, right? So I went back and did it. And I did it as a private practice doctor working basically on call. Like it was me, him, and one other person. And we shared call. We had three independent practices. So it's kind of cool to have your own patient that you could follow through. But it became very difficult, even just having the small practices that we did, because there was only three of us. And my youngest was like 4 years old at times. So every time my pager would go off and I'd go, like she'd wake up at 3 a.m. and just sit there waiting for me until, and I would bring her donuts from Dunkin' Donuts.
Always bring you the donuts home when you're coming in.
And so as a result, I ended up, then I was like, okay, I think I'm really done with OB. But, you know, I'd worked in academics and then I started OB in private practice. So it came with a tail that I didn't anticipate. I was like, now I have to do my deal. So that was a bummer. Because in academics, you know, it's not a current space. It's, No, it's a current space, not the other way. But anyway, that was my story. All right. So let's get into it, guys. Let's talk all things vulva, vagina. I mean, unless you guys have anything that you want to bring up, you know, that's been a burning issue with a patient or a burning vagina you treated this week or anything like that.
There's always a burning vulva and vagina.
That's always.
I think what I was telling a patient actually this morning, like, I think it was hard and y'all would agree, like, that we are honestly like the last line of defense, I feel sometimes, because people, by the time they see us, they've seen five people or they've been dealing with this for so many years. And like, but what they don't know behind the scenes is that there's sometimes where we're like, I'm having to like phone friends and like, you just have to, because we all work together. So, you know, like, and I know when we go to our meetings, like when our last meeting, we're all sitting at dinner, we're like, maybe we should start ordering this test for this condition. And
that's how it starts, right? Like that's how, even if I think back to like even understanding, you know, we now know between connective tissue disorders and inflammatory responses and endometriosis and all the things. Like I remember having these conversations with people at Ishwish, like, have you ever noticed that all your patients that have endo have POTS? And, you know, like, and then you put the pieces together and then all of a sudden people start like, let's look at this even closer. And then you meet other people. Yeah. But I think that's how science changes too. It just takes
what's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best. I know you've had Alexis Cutchins on. I listened to the podcast and I, you know, low key obsessed with her.
Obsessed. She was
like, but like I heard her say something and she said, I think doctors should go, like, as part of continuing education, should be required to go to other specialties meetings.
I think
that's so like spot on, because you learn so much by collaborating and working with other specialties, because we have siloed ourselves off in medicine so much. Right. I just do this.
Right.
And this is my box. And I'm a gynecologist and I just do uterus and vagina.
Yeah.
And like, and what gets neglected and all that, you know, the vulva. Yeah. We didn't get trained in vulva. And, and then you start talking to other specialists and like, and a cardiologist, you see people with pain in their genitals. That's, you know, I see that all the time, but and it's just, it's interesting.
Yeah. That's how you put the connections together.
It's
right?
So fun.
And that's what Ishwish does so well. I mean, we all could talk about how much we love Ishwish, but I mean, unlike any other conference I've been to, it's so multidisciplinary. And I learned so much about the spine and nerves and like the brain and things that like we weren't trained in, because I'm a gynecologist, right? Yeah. So I just love that. And then also kind of going back to what you were saying about, you know, we always say vulva is a team sport. So I also love how we, you know, can always talk to each other about, we at Ishwish, we meet each other. We know who's working in this space. And when we have these hard things, we can be like, hey, what do you think about this? And I love that we have that collaboration.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, I don't know if you guys were at the Lunch and Learn with Cecilia. I can't remember her last name, but she discussed sort of some of the issues from like a patient perspective, but also from like a law and sociology perspective. One of the things she said is one of the issues that patients notice is when we're so siloed that we start seeing people as just their parts. And so patients like start to think that too. And so some of the patients with really bad vulvovaginal disease, like there's even this whole idea of like, they're thought of as the heart sink patients, that when a clinician sees them in the waiting room and they know who they are, their heart sinks because they can't, like they either don't have the time to help them or they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But the patients are aware of that too. And I feel like that is the subspecialization of medicine that almost has to happen should not leave out all the other things, right? And I think one of the things that we do in our private practices is really talk about other systems because we have time to kind of explore it, right? But I think, I totally agree with you. I think that that's one of the things that it makes Ishwish special, but also helps us understand that really women's health is a team sport. Like we can't do it without anyone else. So,
absolutely.
So let's just start with sort of missed opportunities in vulvovaginal health, right? How often are people coming to you guys? And I know you're in different parts of the country, but we all see it. Multiple times, yeast infection, untreated. It's not yeast at all, right? Like, When how often are you seeing that? And what is it usually when you guys see it?
I mean, lichen sclerosis is probably the thing that always comes to mind,
right?
You know, that and you hear that in so many different scenarios. I mean, even in passing, I'll hear people like, well, you know, I had like my daughter, you know, she had a baby and she has all these yeast infections. And I'm like, it's not yeast infection. That's like, it's gross. But that's probably the most common thing. But I think even just complex genital pain can even present as itching in the vulva and burning, and people think it's a yeast infection. And then you get these patients and they come, you know, we know they show up with a binder about this big of so many tests and you kind of have to take a minute and go, you know, like validate it and go, yeah, I understand, but you have to realize you're still not better.
You need
to look more outside of this cotton swab.
Yeah.
That's going in your vagina when your problem's on your vulva.
When I think about lichen simplex chronica, so just kind of chronic inflammation from scratching, things like that, and then contact dermatitis too. I mean, definitely, got some patients recently that are real into that Vagisil, things like that, that like they think are helping them. It's helping their pain, but like ultimately, like I think it's actually causing their pain because it's like they're reacting to it.
Yes.
And so that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I do think some people don't recognize that itching is a neuropathic pain symptom too, right? Like, and so I think those of us in the space have come to realize it. It's not something that's, I think, wholeheartedly ever talked to us. You know, like it's only like, oh yeah, but you know, the itching was actually a result of, you know, an inflamed nerve or a peripheral nerve or an end and a nerve.
Yeah. And I don't know why women particularly, I don't know, like, and why it's so, is it more PC to say it's a yeast infection? Like automatically they just go to yeast. That something's wrong down here and it must be a yeast infection.
Mm-hmm. Right. And probably like because they can self-treat it too, right? In this age of us direct-to-consumer stuff and how, you know, I mean, we can talk about this too, how the whole idea of us as clinicians and doctors going to get like weeded out in the future. Like, you know, all these tech companies are saying all this stuff about AI is going to replace doctors. I don't know if you saw that when they had the big Chase healthcare conference where all the like venture capitalists can come and they try to see who they want to fund. This one guy, I can't remember his name, I'll have to put it in the notes, but he said, you know, we tell doctors that AI is not going to replace doctors, but we only do that so they can give us all their information because AI is going to replace doctors. I mean, he said it blatantly, right? And you're just this is what's, this private equity concept is really screwing up, you know, it's screwing up medicine because their bottom line is always going to be money, right? Like, you know, the bottom line is money. And so I think that is, I mean, and I think there's probably a role for AI and everything that we have to accept it to some degree, right? Like, I don't know, but I mean, how are you guys seeing it in your practices? Do you see people using AI a lot, ChatGPT, these chat boxes?
Oh, I have patients that'll chat, you know, oh, chat said this, you know,
yeah.
I had one, it was a while back, but she said that the progesterone IUD was FDA approved for uterus lining protection with menopause hormone therapy. And I said, well, chat's got that one wrong. That actually is not the case.
That's a lie.
And so, good try, chat, but that is actually not true. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's not perfect for sure.
No.
Yeah.
No,
I've had a patient I had a patient find me by ChatGPT. I mean, I was like, oh, it's so interesting. But, you know, I think if you are, you know, a lot of these patients are like Googling where they can find help, how they can find, you know, like what they can do. And then I think people like the three of us sometimes will appear just because we have blogs or podcasts and things like that. And I think that's actually really helpful. I was like really surprised, but she was like, I've had this pain for 10 years and no one's been able to help me. And like, I found you, and I was so glad she did, because I did an exam and I identified what the problem was. And so, it was, you know, just some light complainants that no one had ever looked very closely at. So I was happy that ChatGPT had sent her my way. So I think for those kinds of things, it'll be good. I think it'll be interesting how AI changes things. I think it can be helpful, but you know, so many of our patients, what they really need is someone to listen to them. And validate their experience and not feel dismissed. And I just don't think that AI is going to be a good handholder and really like have the empathy that I think all three of us probably are really good at providing to patients, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and plus it's algorithmic automated care, right? And so we're all about nuance. We're all about looking at the person in front of us.
Yeah.
And so you're telling us now that like we're going to automate care that is written probably by a white male. It's not going to take into anything else into consideration, which will just layer more bias in medicine as we speak, I think, you know. Yeah. So I think that's what's that's where I have trouble with it. But the one interesting thing that I've found is, I was just telling guys offline that my son turned 16 and he had the flu. And so these kids are using ChatGPT, right? So he comes to me asking if he should be on X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, okay, you know, like I'm an actual doctor, right? Like, you know, my husband. And so then I take him to the pediatrician because he needs to get swabbed. And I was so surprised at how he could communicate with the pediatrician because he had used ChatGPT to help. It was, and I think that is where we'll see the tool as a benefit, because I never thought of it in this capacity. But the way, I usually have to interject with him every few minutes when I'm with the pediatrician. I said nothing because he hit all the things that the pediatrician needed to hear. And I was like, well, how did you know to say all that? And he goes, well, when I was ChatGPT. Like, so I think in that capacity as like an advocacy tool, it might be beneficial.
Yeah.
And so that was when I said, okay, well, maybe there's something.
Yeah. Well, that'd be curious, like with the, like, just even how are you using it in diagnostic tools, you know, like imaging and things like that. Like I know at the menopause meeting a couple years ago, they had a GYN oncologist and they're talking about how using it with like a colposcopy where you're looking at a cervix and like it can like detect where to biopsy and how it was probably better than human detection. Yeah. And then there's a recent Ms. Medicine lecture with the breast radiologist. It was great. And she was saying how with breast density, you know, because which is determined just by the radiologist's interpretation and visually, and that they have an AI tool that they can kind of turn on, which actually is pretty good at kind of maybe even swing them more one direction or the other to really decipher, is it more dense, is it less dense? Like, you know, like you might be a C plus or a C minus, like kind of, you know, something along those lines. It was really interesting to see it. She's like, when you're kind of in that gray zone and you don't know what to call it, you can turn on this AI tool for the mammogram. And
I think in some capacity for our patients who, you know, because I think we deal with people who are already have become depressed and anxious because of their chronic vulvar or vaginal conditions. And so maybe in some capacity it might help them to better, you know, because it takes a lot of, I think, intestinal fortitude to keep going to a clinician doctor over and over again, right? Like, and so I give our patients so much credit because, you know, then they have to go and relive the story again in hopes that your rating that, you know, you heard about that this doctor might actually listen and have some different response. Like, I think that's what I see is like very interesting that, you know, maybe this will help, you know, them to collect their information better or something. You know, I'm just thinking how it might help the vulval vaginal world.
It gives them, you know, like your son, just more tools and information to just communicate.
I was like,
might even just shed more light on situations for them to be more vocal and comfortable even with this, to validate like, hey, this is a real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, because it is, like you said, it's so isolating because this is such a you know, shameful part of the body. And if this is something that's wrong with me, I'm the only person that has this. But really, this stuff is so common. We see it all the time.
Yeah.
It's just people talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. It's a, you know, it's a silent thing.
Yeah. And it may help give them the language to talk about it too. Like the anatomy, the part, you know, like we talk a lot about in our podcast, like, you know, women aren't taught these, like their vulvar anatomy, like the labia and the labia minora and the labia majora. So often I'll ask you, well, where does it hurt? And like, you know, is it the inside or the outside? And if it's the outside, where on the outside? I'll pull out my little vulva puppet, like what you have, and say, like, where? Yeah. Show me where. Yeah, exactly.
I literally, this is my problem. I have this sitting on my desk, and I always think, I'm like, God, this vulva is staring right at the patient sitting across from me. But I'm like, they're like, it hurts. So I'm like, show me where it hurts. Like, sure. We're on this part. You know, because they know, but they just may not know the nerves.
Right. Yeah. But I think that's, you know, why I think our education is important for helping them to kind of delineate. Because you can't really get help if you don't know how to communicate that help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I think that's they call it like a cultural health capital almost, where like you have the right language, tools, and vocabulary to get forward when it comes to your healthcare. And that would make you have like a more successful outcome potentially. Let's talk a little bit about sort of vulvovaginal infections and the most common things. Like, you know, I feel like BV is the infection that keeps, you know, coming. the X that won't go.
Yes.
Tell us, let's talk about your approach to like recurrent BV, for instance, like how, and you guys can both kind of chime in. You might, if one of you can kind of just review for who's listening what we describe as BV and then go from there. And the new research, maybe tell me how you
Ashley's the microbiology nerd, so take this away. She loves microbiology.
I do. I love microbiology and microbiome stuff. And I think that's one of the biggest things I always tell patients, you know, but BV is, it's a microbiological state. It's a microbiome shift. So it's not just one bacteria. It's a conglomeration of not good bacteria and less good bacteria, right? Yeah. So, and usually the symptoms are like that kind of thin, watery discharge and the fishy odor. Although sometimes some patients will say they feel itching or pain, right. But it's generally not because it's an oocyst, not an itis, right? So it's not inflammatory. Although I definitely have some patients that do feel those things. Right. But I guess one of my big frustrations in the BV space is just that I don't know if this happens in Chicago as much as it happens in Seattle. People use these Affirm DNA test that tests just for Gardnerella and it comes back positive, and they end up getting treated over and over again for a false positive BV test when they don't really have BV. I really like either a PCR that's like a multi-spectrum PCR that will look for the good bacteria and the bad bacteria and give you kind of a bigger, like we call them new swabs or Aptima swabs. Yeah. Like, you know, I think that's a much more accurate diagnosis. And I always look under the microscope because I just feel like sometimes that is the like people still tell me their story of like, when did it all start? Well, I had BV over and over and over again. I took metronidazole over and over again, and then I got a bad yeast infection. And now I have this chronic vulvar pain. And I'm like, but it kind of all started from like, did you really have BV or not? I don't know.
Yeah. Or this start like an inflammatory cascade.
Yeah.
And so, and then we had that, but we do know that the recurrences do happen.
Yes.
You know, or at least a third of the time or something like that.
I mean, there's some people, I think that in the microbiome, I don't think we're totally there yet for vagina, but there's something there in some people. There's different types of microbiomes and some people that's more prone to shift in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And so now, and although we never used to classify it as an STD, I think we all had the patients in the past that were just with this one partner would start getting BV. And then I remember, I still remember this patient, and she was like, she finally like ended the relationship and like, she never got BV for like another year or something after that. And so do you guys want to talk about that paper? I talked about it at one point on this podcast, but the paper that came out was JAMA last year, I think, right? Mm-hmm. About recurrent BV and treatment with partners. and are using it, are using it in your office.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's exciting. I mean, I definitely, I agree. It's not that necessarily that it's an STI, but just that like we know that like this bacteria can be passed back and forth, right? And so they, in that study, they treated men with a male partner with oral metronidazole and topical clindamycin, and they saw like a 50% reduction in recurrence. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing to take away from it is they went from like a 60% recurrence rate in that 12 weeks, mm-hmm, to like a 30% recurrence rate. Yeah, so it still did definitely help it, but it's still really high.
It's still
so, like,
really high.
I think it kind of like reminds us that like we don't totally understand exactly why people have these recurrences. And like Mary was saying, we know some people have a microbiome that's more likely to send them down this path. That's just their baseline. And so how do we, what can we do? And, I think that like there's definitely different regimens out there of metronidazole once or twice a week, like the vaginal metronidazole after a longer course of oral flagyl, or sometimes try boric acid. The patients, I'm not always a huge boric acid fan, but sometimes if they feel like sex is one of the triggers and the partner's already been treated, and sometimes boric acid after sex, that kind of thing. Meredith, do you have other things that you try for recurrence?
I mean, I am always, I ask every single person like about their period because some people hear people like, every time I get my period, mm-hmm, and like, well, that's blood, and blood is a higher pH, and right. And part of the diagnosis of BV is a pH above 4.5, because mm-hmm, your normal vaginal pH is 4.5. And so there's probably something in women who think these, with their microbiome, that just lives at a higher pH, they have less, good lactobacillus. And so it doesn't take much for them to flip to symptomatic. And so you'll hear, what's worse with my period? So could you maybe work on their menstrual bleeding? And then of course, semen is also basic. And if they're having sex without a condom and with the penis, and it's like, I just really want recently, and she had BV and had odor and all the things, and then ever since she's been using a condom and has not had BV. So you kind of like, even just like, just what's happening and creating disruptions in their microbiome.
And I think the key is here, like, we have guidelines and we have algorithms, but there's like no one size fits all when it comes to somebody for complex patients, right?
And
it's like you're throwing the same thing at every single patient. One microbiome isn't identical to another. Do you guys like those direct to consumer sort of, kits that people offer?
Yeah, I think I think they're promising. I think they're great in data collection.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we'll get a lot of information from it. But again, like you have people with certain symptoms that reach out to these things, and it might be a vulva itch and burning pain that they come back and they're like, well, it must be this because this Q-tip in my vagina that I sent off has yeast on it, and or it's like a sclerosis.
Does someone live in your vulva? Has anyone ever lived in your vulva?
Yeah. I mean, I ask women all the time, like, I went to the emergency room and I had a pap smear. I'm like, well, you don't really get emergency pap smears in the emergency room. And then I'm like, did anyone even look down there?
Yeah.
And they often don't. They just empirically treat them for things. And they say, well, it has to be, a UTI or BV. And it actually requires an exam. AI isn't going to do that.
Exactly. And it's like, I know, most of us probably, I feel like lichen sclerosis, some of these conditions, you can't unsee once you've seen it enough, right? Like you mm-hmm. can't unsee the loss of the labia minora. You can't unsee mm-hmm. these patches of, lichenification and all things. So, but what I think happens, and tell me if you guys agree, is that because we in gynecology really, I'm sure it's changing now, but at least when we were getting trained, didn't have this great sort of understanding of vulvar anatomical changes that happen. Nobody
seen that.
Yes. Exams should start by, let's retract the clitoral hood. Let's look at the labia minora. Let's look at the labia major. Let's, not just swab for STIs or, that lesion that might be herpes, right?
Yeah. I mean, Ashley and I trained at the same place. And I don't know if you guys, if the clitoris was a no-go zone.
No-go. No-go.
Yeah. Don't consider it.
It's uncomfortable.
Yes.
It's like, okay, And there is obviously new, you can't just, examine a clitoris without explaining it to, you can't, there's bodily issues we have to address, right? Like mm-hmm. we in this space do have to be cognizant of the fact that like we have to talk to our patients while they're dressed and tell them exactly what we're going to be doing, right? And because mm-hmm. I know that people have gotten, I remember hearing at Ishwish maybe five, 6 years ago, there was somebody who started examining clitorises after or maybe didn't explain it. And so I think got like written, you know, something happened from a legal perspective to him. Hmm. It happened to be a male too. So I don't know, you know, to what extent you weren't communicating why you're doing it, right? And so there's always that issue. But I think for sure we were told never to examine clitoris, which is like, you know, urologists are never taught to examine.
Right?
It's the go-to. But yeah. Well, I think, again, it goes to the fact that, like, you know, we don't value women's pleasure, I think, you know? We're just trying to, like, you know, take the fires down and make sure that things are not, like, inflaming red on fire kind of things, yeah. But not trying to make life better without thinking about it.
Yeah. If you don't acknowledge it, it's still just this shameful, we don't talk about organ.
Organ, right.
Yeah.
The only organ made for your own litter.
Right.
Which can actually cause people problems.
Yes.
Problems.
You know, if I have pain and it's in my clitoris, like how terrified are you to reach out to a doctor about that?
Totally. Totally. Right? Yeah. And so that's why I loved when that New York Times article came out with Rachel, you know, like the half the world has the clitoris. Why are doctors not examining it?
Yeah.
Because like we were told not to examine.
Yeah.
Everyone, don't touch that. Yeah.
Don't touch that. So I do think that, you know, things are changing now. People are like a little more aware, but I still see it all the time. I'm sure you guys do too. Like, how did they not see this on your vulva? Right. You know?
Yeah. I think people, I mean, I often think to just put the speculum in and do the pap smear. That's what you're down there for. Right. Mm-hmm. So it just gets, it's a flyby zone, flyover zone. You just don't even notice it.
Yeah.
So it's just terrible.
And right. And nor do you really have time to notice it in a 10-minute visit. Right.
Like, absolutely.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, we all work outside of the health insurance system, but I can tell you, like, having done it in an insurance-based model, it's challenging to try to see the number of patients that you need to keep your roof open, you know, yep. Or dictated by your medical, you know, institution that you work for. You have to see 30 patients a day to keep, you know, whatever.
Keep the lights on.
Yeah. And so, you know, we all know the healthcare system wasn't built for women in mind. So,
no.
I mean, really no patients, but especially not women. So what about like when it comes to recurrent yeast, are there any go-to things that you guys, and have you guys tried like, you know, because isn't it, don't you see when you start women on menopausal hormonal therapy and then they, you know, yeast love estrogen. So yeah. They're always like, wait, what? I thought like this was supposed to help my vaginal microbiome. So, you know, the people that have tendencies to it, what do you guys do for recurrent yeast infections when you know it's yeast? And how do you distinguish between, you know, do you guys do testing for the different types of yeast and everything?
Yeah, I mean, I me being the big microbiology nerd I am, I just love the yeast. And I've had some really interesting patients lately with, like, I had a Candida lucitane the other day, and I had a patient with recurrent Saccharomyces cerevisiae, like, could not get rid of it. I just did, though, and I think we finally persevered and got it. But anyway, but it's just been fascinating. So, I mean, I, for, like, you know, for a regular recurrent yeast, Candida albicans, which is kind of our run-of-the-mill yeast, I will put them, if they've had it, by the time they've gotten to me, like, this has been going on for long enough, but usually I'll do a couple of doses of oral fluconazole, and then I'll put them on a suppression once a week for a couple, like, for 3 months and see if we can come off of it. I definitely have some patients that, like, I'll leave on for longer. Definitely have this lecture from Jack Sobel seared in my head of like him saying that this is a genetic thing. Some people are genetically predisposed to getting more recurrent yeast, and some people need long-term like azole suppression. So I was always kind of scared of giving people for too long, but I think some people just need it. When you stop it comes back.
Yeah.
There's more and more azole resistance, though, in some of the in Candida albicans, and then Candida glabralta is the other one that's most common, and that one has a lot of resistance. So I think when we get into these more rare yeasts, we get into these places that we don't have as many options. There was this great medication called Brexafem on the market for a while, and now it's not for unclear reasons. I don't even know if it's ever going to come back.
Do you use Vivzoa at all for the postmenopausal woman?
I think I've used it like once or twice, but I know like that Jack Sobel was giving that lecture, and you know he was saying how they've compared Vivzoa to the weekly fluconazole, and it's pretty much the same, you know. Mm-hmm. So I tend to use just the weekly fluconazole.
I think for Canada, Galbraith might, you know, be a little bit better. I guess it's supposed to be like fungicidal versus like fungistatic, meaning that it's trying to really, for those listening, eliminate all the fungus as opposed to reducing it. And so, you know, is there, I have used it a couple of times when, you know, it's gotten approved by insurances because I see it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, we'll see. I mean, it'd be nice if more options were.
Yeah, they're tough. Those are really tough cases.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, if it's like a really, I mean, we've all probably all seen these really bad vulvar vaginitis. It's really like, oh, it's so, I mean, I just remember seeing the most enlarged vulva ever. And I was like, this is yeast. And people were like totally blown by it because, you know, the labia can really get edematous when it's really on the vulva. So I think that's something people consider enough either. And what's your take on the over-the-counter one-and-done doses that'll, like, blow it to the next level.
Yeah. Honestly.
Don't do it.
That's so bad.
Do not do the one-and-done.
So bad. And there's no going back if your vagina is not a fan. It's it's over. It's bad. It's, like that thinking, bad to sell.
Right?
Why are they over-the-counter?
Why are they over-the-counter? I wish you'd do that one day. The next time we're together, we'll go through that. You know how some people do that?
They'll
go
the drugstore.
What did... How many? 2 out of 3 OBGYNs recommend.
Yeah.
Go and see. 2 out of 3 vulval vaginal specialists. What do we recommend? Are we 3?
3 out of 3 do not recommend.
Yeah. 0 out of 3 recommend this. No, it's so true, actually. And I think that's sort of one of the things that I see sometimes, like, start precipitating some of the worst inflammatory infections, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And the dreaded medicine that makes you urinate sugar for diabetes. It's some of the worst yeast infections I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. No, you're right.
I actually had a patient the other day and I saw it on her med list. I thought, oh God. I'm like, are you okay? She's like, I'm fine. I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, you're like the one person I think that I've ever met. But I don't know because they come to us because they have problems from it. But she was doing fine with it.
It's totally true. And then I wanted to ask you guys about how you treat sort of when it's in between inflammatory, infectious, and hormonal. Like, what's happening with something like a desquamative inflammatory vaginitis, right? Like, that's one of the things that I think we see a lot of because of what we do, but probably I have a lot of clinicians that listen, so there might be people that have never seen it or heard of it in practice. So walk us through the type of patient you see with that kind of condition.
DIV is what led me to the vulva conference, actually. ISSVD. I was so frustrated and I just felt like I wasn't helping this one particular patient. And I literally looked at her and I said, I feel like your vagina skin is falling out. Like, I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's just so much copious discharge that they have. Right. I mean, it hurts and it pains. Like, it's just the worst. It is the worst. And then recognizing, oh God, that's what it was. And at the time I just gave her estrogen cream and it kind of got a little better. And but those are really tough and it's not an easy
diagnosis either, right?
No, it's kind of almost a diagnosis of exclusion sometimes, but you know, it's the using the microscope and the pH and the story. And so many of them are in that perimenopause and menopause time when it comes, but I've seen it in younger women
too. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah. I think it's hard. Sometimes I have patients who come to me, I'm sure we all have this. Well, I don't have the symptoms today. You know, I'm like, the thing is your discharge is normal, but they send me pictures of like, you know, like discharge that looks just like DIV. And I'm like, but you know, like I need you to come back a different day, you know? Yeah. So I always think it's, you know, I'm sure some clinicians are like, ooh, pictures. I personally am like, oh, pictures, awesome. Like, I want to see what it looks like when it's really bad.
So can you explain to the people listening, like, how would you define it and how would you diagnose it?
Yeah, I mean, DIV is a high pH, usually higher than 5. I mean, bright blue on my paper. Yeah, my pH paper. And then tons of white blood cells. It's super inflammatory under the microscope. And then lots of what we call parabasal cells, which are cells that are like that first layer of like mucosa in the vaginal mucosa. And I think of them as low estrogen cells. So they're not necessarily that, but just like that first layer, but they're sloughing. I mean, it is kind of like the skin of the inside the vagina is sloughing off.
Exfoliating.
Yeah. And then they usually have like you see inflammation inside either at the opening or on the cervix, and they just have copious discharge. And so those are kind of the ways that we define it. It's something that will never show up on a swab. So these women often will come in, have been tested a billion times, and everything's negative.
Yeah.
But and a lot of times they will, you know, it is kind of on the spectrum of this, you know, aerobic vaginitis, right? But it's like, it's hard to say if there's a particular bacteria that causes it. It's not really an infection. It's like a non-infectious, like inflammation, basically.
Yeah. I kind of look at it as like a skin disorder.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, and there's some thoughts of like, is it kind of like, it's like implantus associated? Like, we just don't totally know all the things we need to know about it yet, but you can kind of see it even along and with a like implantus patient, like they'll have it in the vagina and it creates a DIV picture. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. And so I think most of us have to like compound something for them to use. Like I use a steroid, clindamycin, estrogen combo set. I'll learn this.
Just hit it.
Maybe a little bit, you know, work on a little, maybe. Yeah.
Well, see, a lot of the recommendations are like, well, use Clinda, you know, every night for 4 weeks and then drop down. And then if that doesn't work, add estrogen. And if that doesn't work, add hydrocortisone. And I'm like, why are we doing this? Yeah, like, just, at least by the time they get to us, they've been messing with this for a long time. Like, all three. You take all three.
All three. Exactly.
Yeah. And a lot of them need a maintenance after even. Like, it's, they might even need to use something once a week, I find. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they all need vaginal estrogen after.
Right. Yeah.
After just keep that pH
better. Yeah, and I think those are the, because it is true, because then they always have like the stickiest sort of discharge, and it's like stuck, their vulva can be stuck to each other. And so I think those are some of the cues that we see. But and unfortunately, I feel like we deal with the patients, and we were talking about sort of like the patients that get gaslit, but let's talk a little bit about medical gaslighting. Like, what are the most common stories you hear from patients who've seen multiple providers? Or what's the most, like, what, someone actually said that to you? Like, did you guys have like some good ones? We all have some.
Yeah. I had one this week. It was like, oh, so bad. And this is just a virus breast cancer patient and was doing really well on Duo-V, which is a great option for her. Yeah. You know, two medicines in one pill, both negative at the breast, treating her hot flashes, protecting her uterus and all the things. And she met with an oncologist who told her they couldn't condone her taking hormones. And she's getting screenings every 6 months. She doesn't have a gene. Like, she's doing all the right things and she's miserable. And then, you know, with her vaginal symptoms, they, you know, wouldn't let her do vaginal hormones. And they said, you're just going to have to figure something out.
You're just going to have to figure something out. Well, that's why I'm here.
That's why I asked you for help.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Floored. I was so mad for her.
Oh my God. I had a patient tell me that, like, her doctor said, well, you've been through childbirth. Like, how bad could PGAD be?
Oh, my gosh. It's so bad.
Like, your body was made for this. You've had babies. Like, so what? You have a little rascal. Like, what? Like, these women are so small.
And the one, like, in the condition that this has a known suicide rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awful.
That's crazy.
Crazy.
I mean, I think women are dismissed so much, especially in these spaces of hormones and pain. And I think a lot of it, because we know so many clinicians actually are pretty well intended, I think a lot of it has to do with lack of education. Like, they don't really know how to help them because no one's taught them. Like, no one taught us. I'm not defending what they're saying. I don't agree with what they're saying, but I think a lot of it comes from lack of time in our healthcare system and then lack of education on these issues, because I think if people knew how to help these issues, they would want to help them. I think they've been told like hormones cause cancer, or they haven't gone past that point of education or 2002 WHI data and haven't realized, oh wait, it doesn't. So that's how this all happens. But I mean, the stories are ridiculous. Like, you don't have enough hot flashes to take HRT. You know,
enough.
Yeah, right. Just like things like that. Or you should, for all the sexual health stuff. Well, I mean, you should just have a glass of wine. You should, you know, whatever it is, relax more.
The glass of wine thing is so common. It's crazy. I mean, it was even in the paper by Kaylee Moss.
Just relax.
Yeah. Make yourself a bubble bath. It'll be better.
Yeah.
That'll make you want to have sex. That'll make you want to have sex more.
No kidding. No more. I mean, you know, the truth is, we all know it's biopsychosocial. It's much more complicated than, you know, one thing or another. But you can't just always tell people everything is super tentorial. Like, it's not, because then it really does become that way, right? Like, how many of our patients become anxious and become depressed because at the end of the day, they're dealing with chronic pain. Like, it's really hard.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's do a little lightning round for some fun, because I know we're about to get, you know, we'll start. Okay, what do you guys think about, do you have patients ask you, should I sleep naked for better about vulval vaginal health? Yes or no?
They don't have them ask me that a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that that's better. You know, like, I definitely have heard people say that you should do that and you should air things out. I tell people, like, if that feels awesome to them, they should do it. If not, then don't. Like, so I don't feel strongly about it.
What about cotton underwear? A must or must have or not?
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Good idea. But again, like, if you're wearing something else and it's not bothering you, it's fine.
I think we all give guidelines for vulval vaginal health. And I feel like these are guidelines given to the majority of women who suffer from one of the conditions. You know, really, you know, most people can probably wear thongs and they're okay. But, like, it's never, like, never wear a thong. But the people that we tend to see, thongs are the worst thing for them, right? Like,
most of our patients are not wearing underwear and wearing dresses because they have pain. And, and that just exacerbates their pain. So
Yeah. I remember I saw one of my patients recently, and she was wearing tight leggings, and my mouth dropped. I was like, "Oh my god, are you better?"
It's a win. It's a win.
She was like, "Well, yeah. How did you know?" I was like, "You're wearing leggings. Like, I can't believe it." And she was like, "Yeah, no, it's true." But I think that, you know, that's what, you know, patients learn to kind of, like, make their lifestyle fit their pain versus, you know, try to fix the pain in the process. I think while you're doing it, while you're getting evaluated, it's something that has to get done. What do you think, panty liners? Are they villainous, or do we think that, like, people, I mean, I think it's like, what are you using it for, I guess, right? Like,
I mean, some of those panty liners have a bunch of fragrances in them and can be irritating. So, you know, if people feel like they need it because they're leaking a little bit of urine or they've discharged, I mean, it kind of depends. I think, like, I love the idea of period underwear, like trying that instead and seeing if that's better. But I definitely think it can be irritating. But for some people, they wear them every day and they're fine. So,
again, it depends on, you know, what you're susceptible to. I wear a lot of incontinence underwear because I just have one exercise.
I was a tampon wearer when I exercised for that. And then I did pelvic floor physical therapy and actually doing a lot better.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. It helped me for a bit. I probably used to sling at some point. I had to get my myself to do it. Because, you know, doctor, you're the worst patient.
Yeah. And all that spare time we have, right?
Yeah. What do you think about probiotics for vaginal health?
Oh, that's a good one.
I know, right? It's hard.
Are we there yet? Is it prime time?
Yeah. I mean, I think I like the idea of it, but I have a hard time understanding how the oral probiotics are really helping the vagina.
Right.
Like, all these companies claim that it helps. So I think vaginally dosed probiotics make way more sense to me. Mm-hmm. I've been using, there's a couple of ones out there now that are just Lactobacillus crispatus, which is one of the good lactobacilli we really want. But I've actually had people overdo it and then had more burning because they had too much crispatus. So I feel like
cytolytic vaginal.
Right.
You're treating extreme and you go all the way to the other side.
So I just think sometimes it's hard. I think, like, the idea of it is really good. In practice, I'm not sure where exactly we have enough data or understand exactly how this can help or what the perfect microbiome is, right? Like, and how we get people there. So I think that we still have some work to do on that. But I think for some patients, like, like for DIV, like when we're trying to kind of get them off that triple cream that we were talking about before, like right. trying to regrow a nice lactobacillus, like environment would actually be good, but it's just trying to, what is there the perfect one out there? I don't know.
And I think that's the hard part with supplements, right? There's like enough standardization to say that, you know, so it's hard to endorse stuff from my perspective. And I think you guys are the same way. Like it's hard to endorse mm-hmm. something that we don't know as evidence-driven as we want.
Yeah, definitely.
But I have patients that come to me on this stuff and they're like, it's really helped. So I'm not going to like, you know, force them off.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I know I don't like that you're on it. No, yeah. But if it's helping them, yeah, like it's, you know, we'll do an assessment of their vaginal microbiome and go from there. You know?
Yeah.
So it's been great. So what I always like to end with, so my husband jokes that like my listeners are vagilantes. So,
I love that.
So what's your hot take or vagilante verdict for like the audience? Like what's the one thing you want people to remember or learn what to do or, you know, what's your hot take?
My thing is know your anatomy. And if you have a problem, tell your provider where it is. Don't be afraid to say vulva or just say outside. Really point and show them where you're having your problems.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that, but you stole it from me. but it's a good one. I also think like, you know, if you're having itching or an issue, you should ask for an exam. And, you know, I think so often women call and say, I'm itching, I must, and then they're told you must have yeast and they're just given an oral medication and it doesn't get better. I mean, they definitely need an exam if things aren't improving. And if you're a clinician, like a lot of clinicians, not to no fault of their own, was never taught about examining the vulva. You need to kind of find your way to someone who knows. And sadly, even not all gynecologists know, because I used to be one of them. Like, we just weren't taught this. So it doesn't feel like you should have to find like a vulva specialist for a lot of things, but for some things you do.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, you know, to a point is like, you know, medicine evolves and you have to keep up with it. So I think a lot of people don't have the capacity to go to conferences or, you know, whatever, based on where they work, right? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, even our understanding of vestibulodynia has changed over the last 15 years. So it's not even something, if we were lucky enough to have someone to know about it in our residency, it's not even something we would have learned about back then, right? Because it's like changed so much. And so I do think that like, that's why continuing medical education is so important and to keep your finger on the pulse of, you know, vulva, vaginal health and hormones and everything. So, and it's hard to do when you're seeing 40 patients a day and you have to go home and chart for an hour and you get 2 weeks off a year and all the things. So like, I think we've all been in that situation where we were there. And so I always give grace to all those doctors out there that are doing all the hard work because, you know, while it's hard to own your own practice, like everyone could agree, it's another child in our life that we have care of. You know, we do have the autonomy to kind of do things on our terms in that capacity to some extent.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, I'm going to put in the show notes, you know, where you guys can be found and everything. But I really appreciate you guys being on. This has been fun. So thank you. And, you know, we'll make sure that we have all your info on how people can get in touch with you and follow you and everything. But thanks for being on. It was fun.
Awesome. Thanks for having us. It was great.
Awesome. So thanks everyone for listening. I'm Dr. Sabina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me again.
Please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.